Hello, JBS viewers. I'm David Harris, and this is Defending Israel. And today, I'd like to do something a little different. Instead of engaging with an interviewer or with a guest, I want to engage directly with you. And I want to do so not with teleprompters or prepared speeches or note cards. I want to speak from my heart, and I hope I can reach your heart. And the subject matter is Israel. Not just Israel since October the 7th, but Israel in a much bigger scale. Let me talk very personally. I grew up in a home where Israel was something valued. My home was quite secular. I didn't visit Israel for the first time until I was in my early 20s. But I knew Israel was there, and I knew it was important to members of my family. In fact, I learned at an early age through a book called The Pledge by Leonard Slater that my one and only uncle, my mother's brother, Jules Chender, had been deeply involved in the months and years leading up to 1948 in trying to get weapons from the United States to the Jews in British Mandatory Palestine. And eventually, he came to the attention of the FBI, and all of it is recounted in this story, The Pledge. I knew that a cousin of mine that I had never met, this young lady, Mila Racine, who was active in the Mouvement de Jeunesse Sioniste, the movement of Zionist youth on the French-Swiss border, had been trying to bring Jewish children from occupied France across the border to neutral Switzerland, had succeeded in bringing over 230 Jewish children to safety before being arrested by the Gestapo in 1943 and dying in Mauthausen, the Nazi concentration camp, 6 weeks before the end of the war. I knew those were my family roots, and there were others as well. But it actually wasn't until I think I was about 14 years old. I was a voracious reader, but I was also a very long sleeper. And I found this book, Exodus by Leon Uris, on a bookshelf in our family home. And I picked it up one evening, again about the age of 14, and I began reading. Now, normally by 8:30, 9 o'clock, I was fast asleep. I needed that sleep. Reading this book was my first all-nighter. I could not put this book down. It spoke to me in such an extraordinarily personal way. Every page, every sentence, every character, every description, even if it was fictionalized, but nonetheless based on history, spoke to me as a Jew and helped me understand the deeper meaning of Israel, its rebirth in 1948. And it prompted me to go and read more and ask more and study more and to understand that Israel wasn't just another country with another flag in front of the United Nations, a mile or two from where we lived growing up in Manhattan. There was something very unique and very special about the return of the Jews to a land with which we had been associated since time immemorial, from which we had been exiled, but with which we had never lost that metaphysical, that spiritual, that physical connection. And all of this began to kind of fill in for me, this understanding of what some Jews in the 19th century, in the 20th century, having left the vicious anti-Semitism of Eastern Europe or of the Muslim world and coming to the Holy Land, wanting to reestablish the Jewish presence, overcoming issues of land reclamation, issues of swamps and malaria, rampant disease, often hostility from the local population as Jews try to coexist and buy land legally and live in some form of coexistence. Of just what this struggle meant by the time 1948 came, the year before I was born, and by the time I saw the Israeli flag and began to try and intellectually put the pieces together. And as I evolved in my own Jewish journey, following Exodus, I came to understand that as a Jew, we sat on a three-legged stool, or stood. One leg was the Jewish people. And I understood this connection both longitudinally through history, my own family and my extended family, if you will, going back to Sinai, and latitudinally, that as I was growing up, I had members of my own family who had stayed in France during the war and continued to live in France after the war. I had other members of my family that moved to British Mandatory Palestine and were among the early founders of the reborn state of Israel. I had other members of my family who were stuck in the Soviet Union, who were unable to leave when my own mother and her immediate family left the USSR. And of course, later when I married my wife, herself from Libya, a whole other Jewish story, the latitudinal notion of Jewish peoplehood was extended even further. And the second leg I understood was a land. And that land was not Brooklyn. It was not Bialystok. It was not Berdichev. It was not Benghazi or Baghdad. The land that I read about, whether in the history books or whether in the prayer books, even as a somewhat skeptical religious Jew, was the land of Judea, of Jerusalem, of Zion, of Israel. That this was an integral part of who we were as a people, with a very specific, not just time, but place. And then, of course, there was the third part. And the third part was a faith. And again, the faith was rooted, yes, in a value system, in a moral compass, in ethical direction, but it was integrally linked with a land and a place. All of it was bound together. So at some point when I first met my Jewish anti-Zionist, how can this be? How can one be a self-proclaimed Jew and at the same time be anti-Zion? Meaning anti-Jerusalem, anti-Judea, anti-Israel, as if our Jewish identity was some kind of a la carte menu where we could accept this soup, but not that main course, but maybe the dessert. Of course, we could lend our own interpretations to a land, a faith, and a people, but to simply rule them out or dismiss them, as if one could dismiss the land? Or as if one could say, why should I be concerned about Jews elsewhere? As if that were not part of my responsibility of being Jewish? This to me was incomprehensible. So this was the kind of identity that I was building until in my very early 20s, I'm trying to remember, maybe 21, 22, I made my first trip to Israel. And I have to tell you, to this day, it sends shivers up my spine. I was transformed in a way that I never really expected. I had been to several European countries before and even on this trip. And I was moved by each of them, France, Britain, Italy, Greece. But something happened to me from the moment, even from the plane, when I looked out the window and saw the Israeli coastline approaching. And it was pretty brown, pretty gray, not terribly verdant at the time, but something spoke to me. My gosh, this is Jewish sovereignty. That house, that tractor, a Jewish house, a Jewish tractor, a Jewish bus, a Jewish airplane terminal or airport terminal. And that experience in Israel, again, was an awakening for me. I felt something that I hadn't really understood existed within me. And maybe it was particularly encapsulated when I was on a public bus in Haifa, I think. It was the summertime. It's very warm in Israel. People were wearing short-sleeved shirts. The bus was crowded. And I was standing next to a gentleman, and his arm was holding one of the rubber straps. And I noticed suddenly the number, the concentration camp number on his forearm. Now, I come from a family of survivors, so this was not new to me. But what was different was the fact that he was obviously an Israeli living his daily life in Israel. And I was a child of survivors visiting Israel from the United States. I did not speak to him, but I wondered from that moment, and I continue to think about it, what was it like for him, having experienced the Shoah, the Holocaust, having experienced complete and utter powerlessness, the inability to define his own fate, which was put in the hands of others and almost led, presumably, to his death and probably to the death of many of his loved ones. What did it mean for him to live in a sovereign Jewish state with a Jewish flag, with the national anthem Hatikva, the hope, with a national language reborn Hebrew, with an Israeli army there to defend the country, and with Israel in control of immigration rather than other countries controlling immigration and too often leaving out Jews? And that, for me, captured that trip to Israel. I came back to the United States, and in a way I was on fire. I had seen something so moving. And yet I came back to an America which was dispirited, which was depressed, where young people were losing faith in America because of the Vietnam War, and then because of Watergate. And I had seen in Israel young people excited and dedicated to building a state and defending that state as necessary. And then in 1972, I was in graduate school, and I was sitting in the library, and I was just looking on the shelves, and I found this book. The book is by Arthur Morse, and it's called While 6 Million Died. Now, 14 members of my family, including my mother and my maternal grandparents, had miraculously entered the United States during, not before, during the Second World War. So for me, America always represented that embrace of my 14 members of my family. But when I read this book, I understand that there was another side to America which I had not really understood. And what Arthur Morse was saying in this book was that America very consciously, very deliberately, at the Evian Conference in 1938, at the Bermuda Conference, through the persons of people like Breckinridge Long, the Assistant Secretary of State, through the unwillingness to listen to the message of the Polish Catholic hero Jan Karski, who came to the United States to bear witness to what he had seen against the Jews by Nazi Germany, that there was another America that had turned its back, that had refused to allow 930 Jewish refugees from Nazi-occupied Europe to disembark from the SS St. Louis. And then I understood Israel on yet another level, that had there been an Israel in 1938 rather than 1948, had there been Israeli embassies and consulates across Europe, how many Jews might have been saved when Hitler was teasing the world and telling the world, you care about the Jews? Take them. They're yours. Take them. And the world had turned its back on the Jews. But those Israeli embassies and consulates would not. So then came 1973, the surprise attack by Egypt and Syria on Israel. And to my own surprise, as someone who had opposed the war in Vietnam, who was part of that dispirited American generation, I found myself calling the Israeli consulate in New York and volunteering, "Can I help in some way?" Now, they did some screening questions, and I was quickly rejected because I was the only surviving child. I was the only child of my mother, and they would not risk anything happening to me. It was a terrible war for Israel, though in the end, of course, Israel turned it around and had an extraordinary victory against both Egypt and Syria. But I sometimes kind of gently joke that had the Israelis taken me, maybe the war's outcome would have been different. So maybe in the end it was all for the best. But then I understood that if I can't serve in the Israeli military, how can I help this country? And then I met my future wife, a refugee from Libya, one of the forgotten refugees, whom I've had the pleasure of interviewing on a previous show. And we both shared this passion for Israel. In fact, two of her sisters, since fleeing Libya, had made Aliyah to Israel, one as a lone soldier. And so she and I began talking about, should we make Aliyah ourselves as a young couple? Should we move there? And it was a long discussion, and in some respects, it still continues. In the end, for reasons of family and education and career, it didn't work out. But I sometimes blame it, if you will, on a bus driver in Israel. Egged is the major bus company. And it was the last bus leaving the bus station in Jerusalem for Kibbutz Geva, where my future sister-in-law lived with her husband as members. And it was a balagan, it was chaos. People were all trying to get on the various buses because after these buses left, 24 hours, no buses. So here I am standing online trying to get on the bus with my future wife. And the next thing I know, the bus doors close and the bus starts to leave and I'm still standing there and I can't find Julieta. The next thing I know, she's frantically waving to me from the bus. The bus stops, the bus driver comes out and like Nachshon parts the sea of people and comes to me and says, "Are you David?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Come with me. I'm putting you on the bus. Your wife, she's from Libya, I learned. She knows how to survive in this country. You don't know how to survive in this country. Don't ever make Aliyah." And that's because I was so focused on the line. Who was I in front of? Who was behind me? And of course, I never got on the bus. So whatever the reason, we didn't make Aliyah. But in 1975, I joined the Jewish world, and I found my ability to embrace Israel, to love Israel, to support Israel, to defend Israel through my professional work. And that continued from 1975, and frankly continues to the present day. And it's allowed me to visit Israel on, I've lost count, but at least 100 different occasions. And I've come to understand on each visit, because each visit still brings that kind of teenage excitement, that excitement of that first visit when I was perhaps 20 or 21. As I continue to look through the airplane window, as I continue to look from the car or the taxi or the bus once I land, and I marvel, this is not just another country. We Jews waited 1,878 years, roughly 75 generations, for the rebirth of the State of Israel. It was in our prayers. It was in our Passover Seder, next year in Jerusalem. And now I'm one of those privileged Jews who no longer has to wait and pray and dream and hope. Israel is a reality. It's a living, breathing, pulsating reality. It's a sovereign state now of 75 years of rebirth. It's a state that has not only managed to defend itself time and again against war, against invasion, against economic boycotts, against terrorism, against lawfare in courts around the world, against every conceivable form of challenge an enemy. It's faced, it's confronted, it stood strong against all of it. But it's also a country that never has lost its democratic soul. People always talk about, can Israel's democracy survive? My goodness, it's 75 years through thick and thin. Israel's democracy has survived. It's full throttled. It's robust. There are any number of political parties, as many as a dozen, in the one parliament of 120 members. They represent everything from far right to far left, from Jewish to Arab to devout Muslim. They're all there. And against all the prognostications, Israel's democracy remains strong, with an independent judiciary, with free and fair elections, with smooth transfers of power. Contrast that with the region surrounding Israel, or for that matter, with many other countries in the world where there are major democracy deficits. Israel's yearning for peace has never diminished. It could have succumbed to cynicism and skepticism. It could have succumbed to a Masada complex that said, we're here, we're alone, we're isolated, no one will ever make peace with us. But as we speak, six Arab countries have made peace and normalization with Israel. And while we're in a very difficult moment since October the 7th, I'm still bullish on the fact that as this winds down, we'll be seeing in the years ahead a 7th, an 8th, and a 9th. And Israel not only has never lost its yearning for peace, but its willingness to take risks for peace. Tell me how many nations victorious in war, subject to invasion, subject to surprise attacks, have been so generous and forthcoming in taking risks for peace, tangible risks for peace. And Israel has never lost its unquenchable thirst to contribute to human civilization. I recall so vividly being in Israel in 1991 during the Scud missile attacks, in 2006 during the Hezbollah attacks, being on those first planes to Israel, not because I could defend Israel with weapons, but simply as an act of solidarity. And marveling in the hospitals, for example, how one moment we would be visiting patients and the next moment the alarm would go off and we'd all rush to the shelters. And when the alarms ended, the doctors would resume, the nurses would resume, and not just their care for the patients, they would resume their research in so many spheres of health and medicine that can benefit the entire world, which is why Israel has received so many Nobel Prizes, so many other recognitions of its achievements. This is the Israel. Sure, it's an Israel which has some crazy drivers. It's an Israel which is sometimes accused of not being as gracious as it might be. I get that. I wish the roads were safer, especially when I'm there and on those roads. But I have to tell you, I marvel at who the Israelis are. This is a new Jew. This was the goal of Zionism. These are Jews who are unafraid. These are Jews without trembling knees. These are not the Jews of the diaspora who feared the next pogrom, who hid in the closets, who hid in the cellars, who hid under the beds, who prayed that maybe there would be a benign tsar or leader who might let the Jews live quietly for a while. These were Jews who were committed to planting trees, to restoring the grandeur and the beauty of Israel, who were committed to building a thriving democracy, a growing economy, and yes, who were committed to defending the country against come what may, whether it's Iran, or whether it was the surprise attacks of Egypt and Syria, or whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah or Palestinian Islamic Jihad or now the Houthis, people who have no respect for life, who proclaim their love of death, who accuse Israel of loving life as its Achilles heel. And I think we've seen, particularly since October the 7th, but long before as well, when people doubted Is Israel still united after the judicial reform debate? Along came the genocidal invasion of October the 7th, and the IDF called for 300,000 reservists to show up. And how many came? And not just from in Israel, but came from Asia or Latin America, wherever else they were working or vacationing. 350,000 or more showed up, including some veterans who are now in their 90s. People who said, this is our country. We're going to risk our lives to defend it. But Ein Brira, we have no choice, and we do it willingly, and we do it eagerly. I even saw with my daughter-in-law's parents, Israelis who happened to be in New York on October 7th. This is their only child and their only grandchildren here. But once their country was attacked, they needed to be there. They were calling El Al every hour until finally, after 10 days, seats opened up for them. They couldn't serve in the military at their age, but they needed to be there. This was their country. And unlike many Americans who served, when you meet Israelis, they don't talk about their service. They don't wear it on their sleeve. They don't brag about it. They're quiet about it. There's this extraordinary dignity, this quiet patriotism, which has always impressed me. These are the new Jews. This is what led Menachem Begin in 1982 to say famously, in the U.S. Senate, I'm not a Jew with trembling knees. I'm a proud Jew with 3,700 years of civilized history. We fought for our country. We died for it. We will stand by our principles. We will defend them. And when necessary, we will die for them again. With or without your aid, he said to the U.S. Congress. This is the new Israel. As I said, I couldn't be more thrilled that in my lifetime, Israel has been reborn. Israel has evolved in an extraordinary way. It's not perfect. I've never sought to defend Israel as a perfect country. It has human foibles. But I've also understood that Israel is a good and decent country that deserves to live and deserves our support. And I've also understood that it's not for me living far away to second guess every security issue as if I'm a graduate of West Point with 20 years of military experience in the Middle East. So for me, if I had to sum it all up, I think perhaps one of the most powerful and poignant moments for me came just after June 1st, 2001. That was when a discotheque called the Dolphinarium on the Tel Aviv coast was attacked by Palestinian terrorists, and some 20 young people waiting to get in and to spend the evening dancing were murdered. And within a day or two, near what was left of the Dolphinarium, someone had put up a sign. And that sign read, "They won't stop us from dancing." And to me, that's the whole story right there. It's Israel reborn. It's Israel as a full-throttle democracy. It's Israel as a contributing nation to advancing the frontiers of human civilization. It's Israel defending itself against every form of terror and threat and evil. And it's Israel saying that in the midst of all this, they won't stop us from dancing. This is David Harris defending Israel.